This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I got me 10 fine toes to wiggle in the sand. Lots of idle things.
Wow. Guys, wow. Welcome to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goyce. I'm Kevin.
And I'm Alice.
And we're the Maisel Goyce.
Okay, does that feel weird? Let's take that again.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
Guys, well, here, should we talk about the title for a hot sec?
Okay.
We thought, oh, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Minches.
No one thought that.
But
you did.
We talked about it for 30 minutes before starting recording.
Well, that's true, but I didn't want to do it like that. I didn't like that title.
Oh, you wanted Marvelous Minches.
Or Maisel Minches. I wanted Maisel Babies.
But
we decided that's what we're going to call you.
The listeners.
The listeners. So, Maisel Babies,
quickly abandoning the podcast listeners already. Guys, welcome to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goyce. Goyce, that's a Jewish term for people who aren't Jewish.
Yeah, and that's what we were.
Alice and I aren't Jewish.
And we asked several Jews.
We consulted.
None honorary, like real Jews.
For real.
And practicing, if that was okay. And most of them said yes, and some of them didn't respond at all.
And some of them, thumbs up emoji. Not sure if it was sarcastic, but I took it as their word. Their Torah.
Our guest next week is actually Jewish.
Oh, okay, great.
So that'll be good.
Oh, we're already teasing that. Quick. Okay, this show.
I don't know. Are we? Take it again.
No, it's fine.
Edit it out. Turn our mics up.
Guys, it's the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goyce. We're here to talk about the marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
You know what we're talking about.
A new show on Amazon Prime. We're hot on the heels of its release about 2.5 months after.
A year and a half ago. I didn't even know that you guys did a pod about it. I thought this was the first and it did no idea.
That's right. On our old podcast, Gilmore Guys, which turned into Bunhead Bros, we did take a little break in the middle of the Bunhead Broing Out and did the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Men with Jamie Wood and Anthony Trolley. And of course, the great Demi
Adigewebe.
Shout
out. He's here right now.
He's not here. He's 1,000% not. No, we love Demi. We miss him. But he's got his own podcast now, guys. Punch Up the Jam, which is terrific.
It's a great podcast. And we decided to do Maisel Goyce. As a direct, kind of just a shot across the bow.
Sure.
Move. I wanted to do this show because it's about a woman doing stand-up. And I think it kind of... I talk about doing stand-up all the time, and it's like my favorite thing to talk about. And if we could do a show about a show like you're wont to do, and
I've only done that
and then
twice.
It covers the thing that I like to talk about the most, it's a great thing for me and for our friendship.
There's a lot of overlap here.
We don't hang out outside this room.
No, that's not strictly true. Although we did meet in this very room.
We did meet in this room.
And I have a lot of nostalgic, positive
feelings
about it.
Kevin and I hang out outside of this podcasting forum. We've actually become friends. Our friendship has grown beyond it, but not, I'd like to say, too far.
Are you kidding me? Too far? Yeah, right.
No, I'm a good friend to you.
It's gone just far. Okay.
I'm a good friend
okay.
to you.
Okay, interesting. I love this framing device. No, Alice and I are friends. And actually, the way this worked out, because it was so fun to talk about this on the old podcast many, many months ago, and I thought, oh, if this came out, would there be any? But it didn't seem right until, Alice, you texted me a few weeks ago, as of recording this, you texted me a few weeks ago before the holiday break and said, we should do Maisel.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of the impetus coming from you where I was like, oh, a female stand-up talking about a show about a female stand-up. That's not the only way I see you, by the way. Oh, yeah, the female stand-up friend. I see you as other things,
too. I'm saved in your phone.
Female stand-up.
Female stand-up A.
Oh, yeah, Siri, text FS, calling female stand-up. So that was kind of a nice lens through which for me to view the show and kind of a reason to do it. So we want to focus on having guests on that are women in comedy that might have like a lot of points of connection to the show in ways that it resonates or maybe doesn't resonate with them in some way, all the while talking about a terrific piece of TV.
Yeah. So we have some awesome guests coming up. They're all either women who do stand-up or women who write comedy or are Jason Mantzoukas randomly wanted to do the show.
I mean, we'll see.
We'll see.
But guys, the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. So, Alice, let's just get into it. Like, as a broad spectrum, here's something that's interesting about recording this right now. In a position I'm not used to being in, is you've actually seen the entirety of season one as is released right now. The first 8 episodes. I've seen the pilot 3 times or 4 times as of now.
Jeez.
But I haven't watched 2 through 8 at all. So that's kind of a reversal. But I think by the time we record the next episode, I'll have caught up.
Okay, good.
But I think it would still be fun for people that like want to watch and then maybe listen.
Mm-hmm.
If they're like to keep it spoiler-free.
I think so. We're not going to do spoilers. I could talk thematically about the series and its arc because I don't think that's a spoiler and I won't ruin anything. But, you know, I watched all of it because I think people will generally sit down and watch at least 2 episodes if they're fans because it's really digestible that way. And unlike the seasons.
Are you talking Gilmore Girls colon A Year in the Life?
Yes.
Okay.
It was interesting to see this show after having watched A Year in the Life and see how, it feels like through doing that, she actually found her footing of like how to create this sort of like bingeable, not episodic, not ship in a bottle type of show. Like it really functions well that way as a series where the story unfolds very naturally and interestingly over the course of the series. Whereas I felt The Year in the Life was like, you know, it seemed clunkier. It seemed like, you know, haphazard. And there was also that weird Beatles.
The Across the Universe
thing. Across the Universe.
Oh, I mean, I'll never forget Alice's face when we watched it for the first time. Just like the sheer horror.
It was tough. I was sick to my stomach.
Yeah, but it does seem like because the production of the pilot of this show and Gilmore Girls Call Your Life were very close together. It was like she either paused Maisel to do the Netflix season and then came back to it, or it was like right one on top of the other. But at any rate, it seems like she really calibrated the kind of lack of restriction that comes with streaming, where it's like, yeah, it can be 90 minutes if you want to. You can do a musical in the middle of the episode. And this, for this pilot, it feels like such a nice pace.
Oh my God,
it's
amazing.
56 minutes long. But it is brisk.
Yeah.
And every scene is purposeful.
Yeah.
And it, good.
Having watched it just twice, like I loved as like some, I mean, I've, you know, dabbled in writing my own content, which is just available for anybody to pick up. It was interesting for me to see how they created, like showed the dynamics between each character with the, in the economy of words that they used. Like the scene I'm thinking of, Midge and Joel having sex outside.
Yeah.
You know, it like first it did on-screen so sex scene. Much in that little tiny scene about like who these two are and what they are to each other and like what he came into the relationship with and what she came into the relationship with. And it like really set up a lot and also showed that they have a lot of chemistry together. Like it's not just, you know, an arranged marriage. Like they're very into each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
I thought that was really kind of graceful.
It was the opening scene. It sounds like we're just getting into
it. Gross, but it was grossful.
You mean it was graceful, very grossful.
But gross.
Well, sex against a tree at Bryn Mawr College.
Yeah. Blarg.
I haven't heard a lot of positive things about it.
No, I've only written a lot of positive things about it in my erotic fiction.
In your Maisel fanfic.
Yeah.
Is there Maisel fanfic by the time this comes out?
Is it erotic?
No, it's not. It's just like Joel goes to the bank.
Joel and Midge's mom.
Midge's mom has got it going on.
Yeah, she really has it going on.
Okay. Well, let's get into it, Alice. Let's get into this episode.
My favorite line of the whole episode.
Can I read the synopsis?
Go for it.
So the synopsis is, in 1958, New York, Midge Maisel's life is on track. Husband, kids, and an elegant Yom Kippur. Am I pronouncing that right?
I don't think so.
Dinner's in the Upper West Side apartment. But when her life takes a surprise turn, she has to quickly decide what else she's good at. And going from housewife to stand-up comic is a wild choice to everyone but her.
A wild choice.
Better than Netflix. I'll say better than the worst Netflix.
They're getting a, yeah, that's true. It's funny. It's funny to imagine that, like, the Netflix synopsis people hire hacks and the Amazon people are like, we're not like Netflix synopsis writers. You know, we actually have a degree.
Wait, David Brooks is writing Amazon synopses? Wow.
Yeah.
So I thought it might be fun to get into it by taking all the pop culture references in this episode and putting them into some sort of supercut in something we'll call Pop Around the Clock Tonight. Or Rock Around the Pop.
Rock.
For sure.
Rock Around the Pop Tonight.
Rock Around
Happy the Days. So, pop culture supercut. Rocking and reeling. I don't, you know.
50. Here we go. The Happy Days segment. We're just calling it Happy Days.
Okay.
All right, guys. So this is Happy Days, where we take every reference, put them in supercut. This is Supercut for 101, the pilot of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Good night, Gracie.
Good night, Gracie.
May have read the book, The Hidden Persuaders.
Best buildup since Iceman cometh.
Dr. Salk should find a vaccine for morons.
In Catherine Hepburn's old room.
It only took 4 years of apologies and a dreidel signed by Sammy Davis Jr. Our little girl is looking more and more like Winston Churchill every day, you know?
Bob Newhart probably used Henny Youngman's stuff when he started.
15 years of watching every kind of loser get up there thinking he's Jack Benny.
Lenny Bruce!
He's on Ed Sullivan.
Doesn't that look like Allen Ginsberg?
Everyone here looks like Allen Ginsberg.
Mort Salk.
You think Bob Newhart's got a instead of these at home, Rickles, maybe.
Made my favorite line of the episode.
She just delivers that one so well.
Rickles, maybe.
That was great.
So this is something interesting now that we're seeing. For the first time in an Amy Sherman Palladino show, she has some limits to the references she can make. And in this case, nothing after the period of the show, which is 1958.
Yeah.
Although I do find it interesting that they never have a title card up that says like 1958 New York. You just kind of infer it by there's like a teeny tiny, you can see the date in some of her notes.
What if in episode 6 somebody just pulls out an iPhone and says, oh yeah, this is just Brooklyn.
We're all just cosplaying.
This is way Brooklyn light.
This is Williamsburg. Like. Yeah. It's fine.
Upper East Side of Greenpoint.
Yeah. So it's weird. Alice and I were talking about, as is the case for a lot of these discussions, at this point, what constitutes a pop culture reference?
Right.
When, okay. Well, if you made a show now, Lenny Bruce would be a pop culture reference.
Right.
Now he's a character.
He's fully on the show. Yeah.
So we'll continue to not have any idea how to do this.
Right.
Of the show.
You guys know that's a preamble to it's going to be a mess.
Sure.
From now on.
I think so. I think this is a beautiful mess.
Fair to say.
Or we'll really be leaning on our guests to like rein it in and be like, guys, what are we doing here? And like sit us down, kind of be our couples counselor. But not like that.
Okay.
Our co-host.
Good. All right.
Can I tell you a true thing? Can I tell you a true thing?
Yes, please.
There's a podcast that's enormously successful and terrific, and the co-hosts go to couples counseling on a regular basis.
On the show?
No.
Okay. Just, can I tell you a true thing?
Yeah.
There was a podcast that I have not listened to that's Esther Perel doing couples therapy, and you can just listen to the couples
I've
therapy.
Heard that, yeah.
I want to hear it.
Yeah.
Now that I'm in a couple.
Mm.
That's in two right, couples. Listeners.
Well, we're pretty polyamorous. Well, we're pretty polyamorous because
we're not in a couple, Kevin.
No,
that's
we're
not
in a
what
podcast.
This is.
No, I know it's not. I'm just saying, like, it's analogous to the.
Do we have to do that?
No.
Hold on a second. Okay. Guys, 1 second.
Hey, we'll be right back.
We'll be right.
Alice.
What?
No, I was just using an analogy.
Yeah,
I know we're not a couple.
Like, I know, but. Just,
no, and I'm not trying to angle.
Okay, can we not hold hands?
No. Okay. You didn't like that?
No, it's getting sweaty.
Okay, I'm sorry. No, I know. No. And that's just a gland thing. And
I know that it is, yeah. And I appreciate that. But if you could take your medication.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry.
Don't call me ma'am.
No, yes, sir. Yes, gender neutral
pronoun.
I
like that.
Yeah,
yes, I like sir.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Guys, sorry about that. So, yeah, it's interesting to see with limits in some ways.
I have
ways,
a boyfriend.
In some ways. Amy Sherman Palladino, the driving creative force behind this show, has no limits now. This is the most budget she's ever had for anything she's ever done.
Yeah.
There's no limits on like streaming lengths and things like that. So she's very unlimited. But then at the same time, period limits you.
Mm-hmm.
And with the kind of like dialogue you can have to make sure you're not anachronistic and not like, sup, chill, bro. But I was actually reading an interview before we started where she said, I just don't want to have to write Snapchat into a script.
That's amazing.
I wanted to go back to a simpler time, which was kind of a MAGA thing to say, I thought.
Oh,
in the interview,
totally.
She's like, oh yeah, I wanted to do the 50s. A simpler time.
Well, you know what's crazy though is that her cadence of all that she's been writing has always been very David Mamet. It's always been very like, she writes in this like stylized way that is directly taken from material that references or was created in the 1940s and 50s.
Yeah, I would go one step further and say it's like Howard Hawksian, His Girl Friday,
for sure.
Bringing Up
yes.
Baby. Yeah.
So this makes total sense for her to go to this era.
It's almost like Welcome Home, Amy.
Exactly.
Where you don't have to worry about people of color or...
Yeah.
Although there was a person of color in this episode.
There was, and there are in future episodes.
At
and
the
it'll be interesting to see how she deals with or doesn't deal with that.
But you know what? For the opening of our discussion of this episode, let's talk about the opening of this episode.
Yes, let's.
Hard cut.
Hard cut.
Midge Maisel giving a toast to herself at her own wedding.
Who gives a toast at her own wedding? I mean, who does that? Who stands in the middle of a ballroom after three glasses of champagne on a completely empty stomach? And I mean completely empty, because fitting into this dress required no solid food for three straight weeks. Who does that? I do.
This actually comes into play with a conversation of Palladinoisms.
Mm-hmm.
Palladinoisms, which is maybe signatures or things she's done from work to work. And there's plenty of Palladinoisms in this show already, right?
Yeah.
From like a shared cast of Bailey DeYoung, Danny Strong maybe has a cameo at some point. Alex Borstein, obviously, complicated relationship with parents. Weight and body image issue jokes, things of that nature. And a fast-talking white brunette as your protagonist.
Right.
But then also specific dialogue Palladinoisms, such as...
Anyone who knows me knows I plan. At six, I decided Russian literature would be my major.
Mm-hmm. This girl could name the state capitals at three.
At 12, I found my signature haircut.
Recite the periodic table at four.
At 13, I announced I was going to Bryn Mawr College.
Discussed Schopenhauer's influence on Nietzsche when she was 10.
Oh, my God.
That, of course, is from episode 605 of Gilmore Girls. We got magic to do, and that's Richard Gilmore talking about Rory and all her accomplishments at different ages.
Grandpa.
I know. Rest in peace. I almost said Richard Gilmore. Although, yeah, rest in peace.
Richard Gilmore would have won.
Gilmore would have won. Hashtag Gilmore would have won. So, yeah, from the get-go, there is a confidence in the filmmaking and the storytelling on this show that I think is kind of unparalleled to anything she's done so far. Where it's like you're flashing back and forth. What it reminded me of, I think I've said this before, it kind of reminded me of Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
You know that sequence where Gene Kelly's getting interviewed on the red carpet and talking about like him and Don O'Connor, we play the biggest theaters in the country. And they're playing like in a little barn doing two-step or something. So she'd say something, Midge would say something, and then you'd see like the truth or the reality of it play out in the flashback.
Yes.
Like, he took me to the nicest clubs and bars.
And
then they're at a
burlesque
show. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I noticed that as well.
But you're right in that there is an economy of language in editing and storytelling that's really dazzling to watch.
Yeah, it really is. It unfolds perfectly. And I guess the one thing that I felt was kind of awkward, and also in terms of she'll do things that seem so deliberate that I'm like, okay, this is trying to make some sort of point, but it doesn't actually communicate what the point is to me. So when she's delivering her monologue at her wedding, it's this reaction of the audience or the partygoers that it's so auspiciously not there, or like, what do you know what I mean? Like a conspicuously not there. Like, she'll say something funny that's a joke in the show and then the whole room doesn't laugh. And it's really weird. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Oh, that's so funny that you, that was your takeaway. Because
I'm like watching it from the, and I know she's going to become a stand-up. So I'm watching this as like, okay, this is her, we're establishing not only her life story, but we're also establishing that this person is good at performing.
Yeah.
She feels confident in front of a large group of people. She can work her room really well.
Yeah.
So this is a natural, you know. But then the audience isn't laughing, which is weird, because why would you not laugh if a bride was addressed? I mean, everybody would be like, yay, everything you had to say, no matter what you said. So, like, it's a weird, you know what I mean? That just seems strange to me.
I could almost see it as, and maybe this is, like, too deep a read, but I could see it as, see, the kind of family and the situation she was in never encouraged
restricted her. Yeah,
that restricted her and didn't encourage her to be funny.
Because
and
that does set up later on, and you'll see there's like things where it comes into play of like, you can't, you know, there's, it's a big problem for her. So that does make sense, but also not even a titter at one point. It's like,
not a titter,
you know,
sir.
And then the thing with the shellfish at the end, everyone legit lost their minds, which was kind of weird.
And like, I've seen this pilot four times now.
Like, nobody was laughing except for Joel, which I guess makes the point of like, oh, they get each other, you know.
There was a moment that really reminded me of Goodfellas in a weird way. Or like a crime. Or like some sort
Jay-Z
of like...
Oh, Jay-Z was here for a second.
He left. And it was when they cut to him and he's just staring at the camera. In like a Ferris Bueller-esque sort of way, or Ray Liotta at the end of Goodfellas.
He would be 6'4 and blonde, and his name would be Dashiell or Stafford or...
Joel Maisel.
Again, from the beginning, she's using devices she doesn't usually use in her shows, which is like, it really broadens the scope of like, oh, I think this show could be a lot of different things. We could do jumps and cuts and different kinds of montages and even, you know... use language that she wasn't able to use before.
And I think that part when he's saying his name, I like that because it's like, he's looking at camera, but it's just pulled from her memory.
Yeah,
him. You
exactly.
know, it's not weird or like, oh, now we get the on-camera, you know, confessionals. There's another part where, and it all, I like that she uses the devices that they're so subtle that they could all be justified. But there's a scene where they're after that, when that song plays, when they're driving down the... down to the east side, the lower east side, and there's like dancers on a...
It almost looked like a musical,
It looked like a musical for a second.
So this is the song by Babs, Barbra Streisand. Come to the supermarket in old Peking, Pecking? I don't know.
Peking? I don't think it's Pecking.
Is this a problematic song?
It's interesting because... If you want a fancy fan or a turkey bone and turkey... I mean, it certainly is a problematic song. Like, if you made it now, you know...
It'd be like, hey, Keisha, knock it off.
Keisha?
Yeah, this would be the kind of Keisha jam that she put.
You mean Kesha?
No, Keisha.
Who's Keisha?
It's Kesha's sister who doesn't have as good of a career.
There's definitely a Keisha Cole. All right.
There's a story out about how they got permission to license this. She sent a long love letter to Barbra Streisand or her team or whoever it was. And apparently... Barbra Streisand looked at the scene, cut to this song, which for Amy, she said, I couldn't imagine any other song. So we just cut it in and we just hope, you know, she'd say yes. And she said she watched it the day after the election. So I don't know if she was depressed or whatever, but she said yes immediately.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow, that's crazy. Why did she like that song for it? I don't understand.
I don't know. I think it was exuberant, joyful. I think there's another interview out there about this song in particular.
There's a lot of exuberant and joyful songs of that period. I don't
that
understand
aren't
why
like
use
racially iffy. Yeah,
a racially iffy song.
Sure.
Well, and also, she uses the beginning in a pointed way to illustrate why her
secretary
the secretary is
dumb.
Stupid.
Yeah, Penny Pan.
Penny Pan.
Penny. Pan.
And the last name Pan is like, does that mean that she's somehow biracial or Asian or something? Like, it's weird. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I could see how that is confusing.
It's strange.
Yeah.
It's just unaddressed. And like, that's, you know, it's just an ASP problematic.
Overall, in the broad sense of this pilot, were you surprised by how good it was?
Yes, definitely.
I was too.
I was.
When I first watched it, I was like, I don't know, because after like a lot of the Gilmore stuff and even some of Bunhead's, like, as far as the pilots go, really, looking back on it, I think this is maybe her best one.
I agree. And
it's either this or Gilmore.
Well, we know this from everything we've seen from her.
Yeah.
She's really good, like a master at certain things. And then other things, she phones it in so hard, it's crazy.
Or she doesn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, that doesn't matter at all. Yeah. That doesn't matter at all. Yeah. And everybody's kind of screaming like, it matters. It matters a lot.
Sure.
It's like making the greatest food you could possibly make and then serving it in the lid of a trash can.
Yeah.
You know, there's just things that contextually should all go together. And
by the way,
have you
eaten out of the lid of a trash can?
Down the street, this place called Barrio Dumpster.
Barrio Dumpster?
It's
not bad.
First of all, impossible to get into.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, so Barrio Dumpster, and that's our ad.
This episode is brought to you by Barrio Dumpster.
So I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Is the actress who plays Midge,
Rachel Brosnahan,
is she Jewish?
She is not Jewish.
Interesting.
No.
Okay.
She's not Jewish.
Why?
Why is she not Jewish?
It's like, I get that there's no Jew actors Hollywood.
That's a question for Mr. and Miss Palladino.
I don't understand. That sort of, I mean, I find that pretty bothersome. Like,
really?
She's great. I think she's wonderful and certain things she did really well, you know, but for me, as a stand-up, I'm like, ooh, hey, Hollywood, there's a lot of stand-ups who can act. Stop casting.
I will
so
say,
many non-stand-ups. And then it's like, but she's Jewish, and also this actor's not Jewish. Yeah. So
way back in the day, like 2 or 3 years ago, when she was first writing the pilot, so this may be back in like 2015, yeah. The word around town was that she wanted Jenny Slate as the lead role.
Or
a Jenny Slate type.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. I think there's pros and cons of having someone who's a stand-up foremost, who's then an actress, versus an actress who can like mimic stand-up.
Yeah.
For you, as someone who, do you see yourself as primarily a stand-up or an actress?
Yeah, I do.
You do, okay.
And that's why Brosnahan is very deferential. I've heard her in interviews talk about the art of stand-up and everything and how, you know, it's a really scary thing, and I think she nails it in a lot of ways, and I don't think it's, you know, it doesn't bother me when I watch it that she's not a stand-up. She portrays the character really well. And, like, those parts where they tell the story of her learning this sort of art form is, like, those parts are realistic in a way that I can really sink my teeth into as a viewer. So I'm, as a viewer who has done this for a long time, it's very realistic, and I really love that. And I actually don't think anything else I've seen has portrayed it. Anything else non-scripted.
Well, because there's a lot of shows that is scripted right now.
Yeah, there's so many.
There's a surplus. So I actually, when I heard the premise,
this show gets into what stand-up is about in a lot of in ways that other content I have hasn't done. Like, the process of learning how to do stand-up is very realistically portrayed here.
Sure. And you know what's wild about that is that this is written and EP'd and show run by someone who's not a stand-up. Mm-hmm. Her dad, Amy's dad, was a comedian. Mm-hmm. He was a stand-up comedian. Her mom was an actress, dancer type. I think did a little stand-up. But it's not like her world. She was just in the world or around the world a lot. So it's not like her craft that she's translating. I know for this, they had two stand-up consultants, Jen Kirkman and Noah someone. But anyway, like that's the extent to which...
Noah Garfinkel?
It wasn't Garfinkel. It was someone else. I could look it up real quick. But
so that, to me, is all you need. I don't, you know, to me, it's not like...
Noah and Garden Schwartz.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be written by a stand-up comedian. It's just the shop talk and stuff and all that stuff can be accurate. And I just feel like to cast somebody who is not Jewish in the role of a Jewish person is a little bit bothersome to me.
I know. I don't
that
know.
That rings a bell.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, you can play a person who's a painter and you not be a painter, you know, but like...
Right. When you get into ethnicity.
Thing, it's just like, well, yet another white woman or whatever. You know, it's just like bothers me.
Well, especially too, that's not just, you know, a bullet point and like, oh yeah, there's all these qualities about her, but it's like, it's a part of the story. The Jewish culture on this show.
Such a huge part of the story.
Which is why we're going to introduce two more terms into the podcast lexicon for things that we like in particular about a particular episode.
That we're into.
The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. We're going to give it a Maisel Toff.
A Maisel Toff.
A Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Toff.
Yes. And I would give Brosnahan's performance a Maisel Toff.
A thousand Maisel Toffs over.
To her, yeah.
But for things that we don't like so much.
We don't like so much.
We're going to give it a Yom
Kippur.
Kippur. P-O-O-R.
Say no.
No, but it's usually pronounced, it's usually spelled the other way.
It is. And this time it's spelled Yom Kippur. If something is just Yom Kippurly done.
So you give the performance a tav, but you give the casting decision.
Yeah.
A poor.
Maybe a bit of a Yom Kippur.
Do you think it's complicated by the fact that the authors of the show are Jewish and they okayed it? Because to me, if it was like two non-Jewish people running the show, and they're like, yeah, this is...
I just say, you know, for me, it's the representation issue always comes down to when I watch something, like when you see it represented and you're, you know, maybe a young person, it to see something represented in media, because media is our cultural touchstone. That's our lexicon. We, you know, it's our scripture in a way. And if you see a Jewish woman playing a Jewish person and seeing her, you know, culture such a huge part of, like, that to me is inspiring to young Jewish people watching this, and it should be. And like, for instance, I, Tonya, this really bothered me, and I know that Margot Robbie was a producer on I, Tonya, so of course she got to play the role, that, you know, the central role, but like, to see a person who is a model, an actual model, playing somebody who succeeded despite their own homeliness, like Tonya Harding is somebody who little girls looked up to, say like, oh, you don't have to be a 10, you know, to mm-hmm. be able to succeed in something. Mm-hmm. Look at this girl. She doesn't look like all the other girls doing it, and she's a gold medalist. And then Margot Robbie comes along and it's like, and I'm going to play this role. And it's like, well, cool. That's literal opposite of inspiring.
I see that.
You know, because for me in my job, like I know certain things with depending on who's behind those things, like who's casting it or not casting, but yeah. like who the producers are. Usually casting people don't care about, most casting people in Hollywood are not about casting looks. They want the best person mm-hmm. for the role, but producers are not.
The people who can actually make the decision.
The people with the money, they yeah. want the hottest person, usually, you know? And so those decisions come down to that. And so, you know, it bothers me to see that kind of thing happen.
Yeah. So should we end
not
the podcast?
Do the podcast?
Yeah, I think so. Well, guys, thanks for tuning in.
We gave it a run.
You know, but we got to follow our conviction on this one.
I'm sorry.
It's a bummer.
Did I bring it down today?
No, I don't think so. This is exactly okay. the kind of stuff right. that we can talk about.
Okay, perfect.
With someone who actually exists in yeah. these spaces on a regular basis and mm-hmm. sees this on the ground level.
But we do have to stop.
But could you please shut up? Can we talk about one of the greatest character introductions
please.
Of all time?
Joel.
What?
Far and away.
Like one of the best I've seen in
it's so
in
good.
Any not like, oh, the best in this. It's like,
no.
This is one of the best.
Absolutely.
And finally, you know, as someone who just watches like media or TV or movies or whatever, and sees someone like Alex Borstein mm-hmm. in these various roles, like Miss Celine on Gilmore Girls, or mm-hmm. whatever on Bunheads, or Mad TV, or mm-hmm. Family Guy, Good Night and Good Luck, to finally see her in a role where it's like, oh shit, this is yours.
Yes.
This is 1,000% your
it's
mantle.
It's so satisfying.
Wow. Here's a weird question. Did you get at all Janine Garofalo vibes from
yes,
her in this
for
role?
Sure.
Is that interesting?
Yeah.
I don't know what that is, but I was like, oh yeah, I could also see
Janine was like a huge part of the Lower East Side yeah. like stand-up scene when that was happening. Like she was the Alex
Borstein. In 1958. Yeah.
No, of like the 1990s, you yeah. know? And like that's so cool like to see. Like it's like I feel like it is a bit of an homage.
Uh-huh.
You know, if that's what it was an homage, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh God, I love this character so much. It does so much for me.
This to me was like the kind of X factor that elevated the
me
rest
too.
Of the pilot in
exactly.
a way.
Exactly. It justified a lot of bullshit. But
how
you'll
so?
See. You'll see.
Okay.
Well, like there's not
sure, 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 sure. Happen. We'll talk about the next episode.
But there's what the fuck was I gonna say? Something interesting. You know, you get it. I'm funny.
You get it, I'm funny. Borstein is the thing where it's
the thing where they go everybody who besides Mrs. Maisel thinks she's a guy.
Oh.
Yeah, who's that guy?
Oh yeah, that was
yeah,
an
that's
interesting.
A good, it is a running bit.
But she got Spoiler some alert. Of the best lines in the episode like
that's how you act.
And then just her is like a stable. This is almost like reclaiming the initial vision mm-hmm. of Gilmore Girls in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
Because originally, as it was in the pilot, Luke was not Luke. Luke was Daisy. Luke was a woman in the pilot of Gilmore Girls. And the network was like, too many girls. Can we put a guy in there? And she was like, okay, Daisy's Luke now. So that and all that relation, that wasn't like, oh, my grand vision of the show is like a network note in a weird way. Or at least the impetus of it was
wow.
that. So to have someone for whom, oh she's like
God.
The barkeep and she represents the color of that area.
This is a spoiler, but she does become a man the next episode and it's the same guy who played Luke. Just kidding.
I don't think that's true.
They just don't address it.
I don't think
it.
That's true. That's just Scott Patterson was visiting
the Scott
set.
Scott Patterson.
Yeah.
And
hey.
He's like, remember me from the last episode?
Hey, it's me, Susie.
It's Susie.
What do you want?
Come on, Bear.
Hey.
Let her on the show. Come on. I got to go fishing.
But speaking of the gaslight, every element of the production design mm-hmm. on this show
yeah.
is great.
Finally.
It's a feast.
I know.
For the eyes.
Finally.
Because it's almost
seeing
like,
Bunheads.
Oh
my
gosh.
God, what a
where they had
nightmare.
$0 for the budgie.
So gross.
Yes.
It was all a garage sale.
But I would even go as far as to say, you know, and I haven't seen the entirety of Mad Men, but most of Mad Men takes place in interior sets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you do period stuff, to go out is very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And you can show the world, but doing so, you have to redress and all
right.
this shit. Get all the period cars and dress extras and all this stuff. they go out in this pilot a good amount.
A lot of times.
A lot. Yeah. So the world feels big in a way that it hasn't in other similar shows.
That's
and
true.
It's like colorful and joyful.
Yes,
and
that's true.
There's almost an energy to this show. This is hard to describe. It's almost like anti-peak TV. Because this is not some shows where it's like,
oh,
there's so many different kinds of shows. And some of them are like the difficult male protagonist or like, oh, it's an interesting story. It's historical or I'll say just shows that aren't first and foremost pleasurable. Sometimes yeah. some shows are like, yeah, it's a good book. It's long and like some of the language is difficult, but you'll be glad you read it or whatever. Like Leftover season one or something.
Yeah.
The foremost desire of the show seems to be to entertain you and to be pleasurable.
Interesting.
In a way that I find to be refreshing for like a lot of these shows we see popping up now where that's not the foremost goal. Because that used to be what TV was. It's like just entertain and sell soap, whatever.
Oh, and it's I agree because something about it's like we do have a lot of in this so-called golden age of television content that is has an eye towards like, you know, being somewhat subversive or educational in some way, A Handmaid's Tale or whatever. And then it also has this element of...
this is not A Handmaid's Tale. You know what I mean?
An element of, oh, and then what we're doing to make it more pleasurable is we're going to make it visually appealing in some way or another. And to me, personally, just hate that trend because I think art direction takes the place of direction a lot of the time. The Handmaid's Tale is a really good example for me. Like, I think a lot in that show could be done better and given more consideration. I think people are like, oh, it's a really great, well-done show because it looks like it has an Instagram filter on it. You know?
I know, isn't that funny?
It really bothers me. It's like, ooh, the red hoods or whatever. It's like, that's easy to make look like a good thing because it's, you know, visually dynamic. Or like, I felt like Lost in Translation was like this. This is a complete tangent, but like, I was like, it's just really well art directed, but it doesn't have
a script. It's beautifully shot. Yeah.
But this show is the antithesis of that.
Yeah.
And it's very engrossing and like, yeah, it's like joyful and it moves in a way.
I find that to almost be a mirror of Midge as a character too, where her default disposition does seem to be a trajectory towards joy, right? Like when all this happens and she finds out, you know, Joel's been cheating on her and her life is falling apart. It's not that she's dissatisfied.
Right.
She's already pretty content. She's young. She is, a wife and mother in her 20s. This is where she wants to be. And then she gets rocked out of it. So it's not like, I'm unhappy and I want more. It's like she almost doesn't realize she can have more.
It's an interesting, yeah.
Yeah, which is, I think, is a nice refreshing rather than a trope of like, the frustrated housewife one day.
And this is a testament to how well they set up this character, but like from the get-go, you understand that Midge, she makes, like some people make lemons into lemonade, and Midge Maisel makes like raspberry compote and you know, infused with elderberry lemonade. She, you know, rosemary dabbled. Like she is so... everything in her life is this huge project that she's going to execute so well.
Mm-hmm.
She's not, you know, Rory, in the sense that she's like this, you know, reluctant overachiever. She's like I'm going to go about life and I'm going to do everything perfectly and that's what's going to make me happy. And I'm going to be, you know, and then when she gets rocked out of that, it's shocking to not only her, but to the audience as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that so much about this show. Even beyond the fact that I feel like they get stand-up so right, what I love most about this show is that they get the experience of being a woman in modernity or at any time really well. Because you go about life, I feel like the essence for me of being like an overachieving woman is that you go about life being like everybody loves me, you know, or like everybody wants me to like be, I'm a fun person and, you know, people think I'm beautiful or people think I'm talented or whatever. And then you get all these opportunities and you work hard. And then what ends up happening is that you end up alone because you do too many things too well or whatever. This is a really, it sounds like I'm tooting my own horn, but
no.
But if you're given, like, I'm very competitive and I'm very like into, you know, what I do as a craft. And I feel like that has given me a certain level of success. I feel like I figured out what I was good at and I started doing it. And then like at the same time, I have found that that has led me to a lot of, and I feel like I don't want to go too far into it because there are things that happen later in the show, but like, you know, with her friction with Joel in the pilot, like, she's with this guy who, you know, she supports unconditionally, but her person is too big and too much and too successful of a person, even though she's not doing anything.
Yeah.
He's like, she's just too much. She's just too good. Like, nobody can measure up. And she's not asking anybody to measure up, but his ego is deflated by her essence. And I, for my experience and for the experience of so many of my female friends, like, that is so common.
A small box by a relationship.
Just a relationship or men in your life or, like, your family or whatever. It's like, you're, being a woman in modernity is like, you have all these opportunities to soar and be this, like, you know, phoenix and do all this stuff. But people, like, the rest of the world around you, their reaction to it, that is not one of, like, celebration all the time. Tracy Ellis Ross kind of touches on it in this talk she gives about, like, being, you know, well, she gets this from her friends all the time. They're like, oh, it's not too late for you to have kids and complete your life. You know, and she's like, I have Emmys, you know? But I really love the way they talk about this because I feel like they completely nail that. Like, the perfectionism and then the upset for what comes with perfectionism. When you nail, even if you nail it and you get everything right.
There's a scene that speaks to that really well. Where after the first set, so just to recap, her husband, Joel, they have two kids, and she goes to the Gaslight to watch him do stand-up, which she finds out later in the pilot is lifted from a Bob Newhart routine that he heard on an album that she then hears on Ed Sullivan. But in the car on the way back, she's already looking at his set and measuring it almost like a football coach after a game. And like, oh, how could we have done that better? Run that play better? Use the quarterback? And she's just jotting things down as he's falling asleep in the back of the cab.
You don't really say hello to the audience. Maybe you should write a beginning, something that says who you are or something. What do you think? Good evening. What a nice... Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the nice is a bad word.
So endearing.
All that applause for me? What am I putting out after? One standing ovation, everyone goes home pregnant.
Just on a technical level, by the way, scenes of people writing stuff, whatever it is, whether it's like your lawyer and you're writing your, you know, case or like your closing remarks, it's hard to do that well. And I feel like, and this is very small. This is not a super important scene in the show as the show is set up, but it says so much.
Except for in the pilot, every scene is really important.
I think so.
I think this scene is great because she, you see her in this support. She's, I have so much to say about this. It's crazy. So the first thing that she says is, you don't really say hello to the audience. I love that so much because I talk all the time when I talk about stand-up and I tell, if I'm giving like advice, unsolicited always because nobody ever asked for my advice, but I am always opinionated about everything. I love that in stand-up, it's really important for you to introduce who you are to the audience because that enables the audience to have a relationship with you in which they're comfortable. And that's like such a huge part of doing what we do. And I love that she saw that lack.
Instinctually.
She has an instinct for that. So he is trying to do this thing because he likes it, which is great. It doesn't mean it's not going to work, but she has this instinct from the get-go where she doesn't even know anything about stand-up. You know, she's seen it with him and whatever, but she just like intuitively knows. And I love that. And then when she's writing down, you know, her joke or whatever, like she's writing these things for him. I loved watching this scene and the scene after it and thinking about like, oh, yeah, because there's no pressure on her at this moment to be a stand-up comedian. So, like, for her, it's really easy to come up with these ideas because she's not the one standing in front of everybody. So, of course, she's able to do this, you know, in a way, because she's not considering I have to present
it. Yeah, she's
it.
Not in it. She's just observing,
Jim Gaffigan's wife writes for him. I don't know if you knew that.
Completely? Or I thought they co-wrote.
I don't know, but...
Yeah.
That just occurred to
it's
me
a, it's
because
a
it's
cool,
like that's a cool like supportive relationship.
Yeah, absolutely.
From the outside, I don't know what it's like, but we'll have them.
Might
on,
be a nightmare
we'll have them
for
on
both
the show.
Of them. Yeah, we'll have them on the show.
Yeah, they're actually sitting here. They've just been patient.
Oh man, but yeah, already you can see that sort of thing. And I will say, this kind of touches on something. The whole dynamic of Joel and Midge in the show touches on something that I feel like I've experienced a lot. I wonder if you've experienced it. I know I've talked to other people in comedy spaces that do experience it. For those of us that work and do a lot of this stuff, it's you making a choice. You know what? I can do this and also pay me. For a lot of people, mm-hmm. I won't even say most people, but I think for a lot of people, they're just funny and mm-hmm. it's not their trade or their craft. Mm. And so this almost text, I will say the Joel character, and maybe this is our dynamic. I'm mm-hmm. Joel and you're Midge on this podcast.
And we're not married. But it, not dating.
I know. I didn't mean it like that. I just meant it in the sense of, I know, and I'm happy too.
Okay.
But in the sense of Joel as like this mediocre white man mm-hmm. who thinks he should be, oh, I should be on that mm-hmm. stage. I wasn't fun, because Midge is like, oh yeah, that's just something you do for fun. And she's like working on like the way you would say, oh, I got you a new pool cue for your billiard game every week. But this does tap into a thing of like, man, a lot of people are so much funnier. This is my thought. A lot of people are so much funnier than me that aren't doing this for their mm-hmm. life, that aren't doing this for a living. Mm-hmm. They have like noble work, or they're like, they're accountants or surgeons, or, you know, work at a college or work at a whatever. And they're just like inherently funny, hilarious people. So the idea that Midge just carries that with her, because it's not like at the wedding toast that she's like, yeah, I'm, you know, working on my type five. She's just like, this is this inherent glowing thing inside of her.
Yeah.
That, and she's just that person. So I feel like this show really incisively, and I don't even know if they mean to or not, taps into this insecurity, I think, of people who do work in comedy, where it's like, oh man, like,
they're just easily funny.
Yeah, this friend of mine that has nothing to do with the industry, they're just like, they're funny. So what?
Yeah, but I don't have that insecurity, because I know that performing as opposed to just being funny are two separate entities, and you can't do the performing or existing or the writing without the other stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be able to make it your job, and some people don't enjoy that mm-hmm. and all this stuff. So, and you have to have the discipline, you have to have the confidence, and some people aren't like that, and I understand that. But I think it's interesting to see that, like, Joel, you know, he does start out this really kind of like mediocre guy. Like, he is the support figure to her in their life space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's the one getting everything right. He's the one, like, he can't get the spot at the thing. He can't get it together. He's just kind of not.
Yeah.
He's not pulling the weight in the marriage. And she's doing all this stuff so that he can go on stage and feel good about himself. And when he has that killer set in the beginning, it's like you can already see the flaws before they occur. You can, even though you thought it was his set.
Right. Well, there's that chilling shot of Susie where she's not laughing.
Yeah.
And she looks pissed. And then you find out later because she knows.
Yeah.
That I just love Susie.
That killed me. It was so well done. It was really, really amazing.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is, I'm going to say it, gang, it's a product I actually use. I've been using it for 10 years now. I've made every single website I've made in the last decade using Squarespace, because Squarespace actually has everything I need. If you want to start a completely personalized website with a new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint is your answer. Choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business, and optimized for every device. Easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated optimized SEO tools, so you show up more often to more people and grow the way you want. You can do so much with Squarespace, like email campaigns for outreach. You can have analytics to find out who's visiting your website and why. You can have eShop e-commerce functionality. I used that when I was doing my little bake shop on there for a while. I stopped doing it, but man, the website I had for a little bit looked really good because I used Squarespace. And there's so much I didn't know about setting up my shop that they were able to answer for me over the chat, and their award-winning 24/7 customer support. So right now, go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, let's talk about your social battery. What is it right now? Is it drained? Is it bursting with energy? Why is it at the level it's at? There's all these external factors that can make it the way it is.
Maybe you're less social during certain seasons. Maybe you're experiencing a lack of boundaries with certain people that's making it more drained than it needs to be. Well, either way, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need a little more alone time. Well, either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I've been in therapy for 11 years now, and it has been vital and crucial for figuring out how to not overexert myself socially, to keep my battery at a good charge, to not keep it too drained when I'm dealing with all the people that I actually want to be dealing with, and not dealing with people in the way that I don't want to be, which is of course due to a lack of good boundaries or how to cope with people. And you learn how to do those things with therapy, because therapy gives you the tools to tune in to yourself and understand, oh, I need this. I don't need this. I need to communicate this. I need to say this. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GilmoreGuys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GilmoreGuys.
I want to give a shout out to the character of Joel. I think it's a total Mazel Tov. I love
Mazel
that character.
Tov to Joel.
I love the actor and I love the portrayal, but I really love the character and the way that it's written and the way that it unfolds over this series.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a hard character to write.
Yeah.
I don't see it a lot. I don't see the guy go through being second fiddle to the woman and having an actual melange of emotional responses to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like, in the pilot at least, Joel is very in love with his wife. He's also very unhappy with himself. He feels insignificant next to her. I can see that. And I do sympathize with him in the pilot. I don't 100% go, oh, fuck this guy. You know what I mean?
Same, yeah.
And he leaves her for his secretary, and you still don't 100% go, fuck this guy. So that, I think, is really hard to portray.
Yeah, so that's a Mazel Tov to Michael Ziegen,
I think is
his name.
Yeah.
Who plays Joel.
Yeah, and also to ASP.
Yeah.
For writing it that way.
Well, and too, and I know
it's really balanced.
There's a lot of projection that happens sometimes when we talk about this stuff, but I think a husband and wife team where the woman is in every interview and every press event,
right,
far and away the rock star, and there's the quiet, reserved, supportive one.
Right.
There's a little bit of that coming out on the page in a way that's like really nice and lovely and constructive.
Right, right. And I love the fact that it's written in a I think it's really important. This is where the time period comes in. It's really important that it's based in another time. Like, The Crown does this a lot. Because to me, it's like, I've experienced this in my personal life a lot. I've talked about it on podcasts before, so it's fine. But like, being in relationships with men where I don't feel supported because their egos are, you know, destroyed by, you know, my personhood. Mm-hmm. Me being a lot, it just makes guys insecure. So, but in the time period that they're in, you're supposed to be obedient. You're supposed to, you know, you're supposed to be second fiddle to your husband. That's the way it works.
Sure.
And so it makes sense for Joel to be grappling with this stuff. You know, he doesn't live in a world where men are allowed to be stay-at-home dads or encouraged to support women in a different way, emotionally or otherwise. So it does make sense for Joel to be the way he is. You know, I'm not disappointed in him.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
And I'll say, speaking to that, even though, you know, religiously, I'm not Jewish. I'm a Mazelkoi. I'm not Jewish. But growing up in a lot of evangelical conservative Christianity, you do see that not in 1958, but in 2008,
yeah,
in 2017, where
there's
totally certain adherence to like what people think are the correct gender roles of how they work out in marriage, where you do see sometimes, and I won't even say most people or all or whatever, but just like you can see in certain religion, internalized misogyny that happens when it's like, oh, well, he's the leader, and I guess I'm the helper, and even though I'm way more skilled than him or capable for doing this and this and this and this and this, I have to submit to this because that's what I think the Lord wants. I don't know.
Yeah.
So that was a point of connection to me to kind of see, because, yeah, Midge isn't like unhappy in this, but
no.
it feels internalized in a way where she's hiding her light under a bushel.
I guess she does, but she shines really brightly in her in her role.
Yeah.
Like, she's like, I'm a happy housewife. Look, I heard an interview with Rachel Brosnahan. I can't get it right.
Brosnahan. Brosnahan.
She talks about the scene in which Maisel takes her makeup off at night and then re-puts it on in the morning as, like, this ritual for her that she just gets so much satisfaction out about being the spy. You know, that's not the word she uses, but, you know, fooling Joel. And this is her ritual that she goes through. He never suspects. And she just kind of she wakes up. And when he says to her, you always sleep through the alarm. She just has a smile on her face like, you know, I got him again.
Yeah, you know,
which is a really interesting, you know, that she sees herself as this like fun double agent.
Or whatever. There's almost like a power dynamic there
too. Yeah, there totally is. Yeah.
I like that perspective.
I think we're done.
Guys, thanks for listening. I want to talk about... There's like a handful of standout scenes that I would put up to, oh, this is some of the best stuff ASP has ever written.
Yeah.
One of my favorites is the breakup in the conversation that occurs after Joel goes up and tries to do original stuff, which is actually stuff Midge kind of gave him before he goes up. He completely bombs in front of Imogen and her husband, as played by Billy DeYoung, Imogen. And then they go home. And then this is the one thing, I wonder what you would say. This is the one thing where I was like, oh, this is kind of a leap. That after one bad set, he would want to leave Midge and then confess an affair to her.
Mm.
But even that being said, and I understand why it needed to happen from a story mechanics perspective, the conversation that they have is so good.
Did you ever think you were supposed to be something? And you suddenly realize you're not?
Yes. Married.
That's good. You're good.
Joel, please.
I'm never going to be a professional comedian, Mitch. Never.
No, of course not.
What do you mean, of course not?
What do you mean? What do I mean?
What did you think all those nights at the club were?
I thought they were fun. I thought they were a fun couples thing. Like how the Morgensterns play golf, or how the Myers ballroom dance, or how the Levins pretend they're from Warsaw once a week to get 10% off at that Polish restaurant that does kielbasa nights.
I can't believe this.
I never knew you were serious about it.
Of course I was serious, Miriam. What the hell ever made you think I wasn't serious?
Well, for starters, you were doing someone else's act.
I told you, everybody does that when they start.
If you wanted to be a comedian, you should have at least written a joke.
I tried with the Ted thing.
I wrote the Ted thing.
And it bombed.
Because you killed it.
No, forget it.
That moment of her saying, because you killed it, like, I love how much you see her. To me, that's why it's not a leap. She says in that moment everything, saying like, yeah, you fuck up. And I don't.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's why Joel can't exist in this marriage.
So you're saying it's not literally the events that occurred. It's like, oh, this is symbolizing a buildup of insecurity.
A buildup of insecurity in which she's nailing it, you know, and her role in life is perfectly executed. His is not. He's not measuring up to her. And in a lot of ways, he never did. And this is all coming to a head, and he's getting validated by this young woman in his office scenario, because it's like he can exist with her. He's a rock star with her. And with Midge, he's just shitty. You know, he's just a guy who can't do this. You know, he's just a guy who goes up and fucks up the joke and can't write his own shit, and he sucks. And she is completely oblivious to all of this, as you can see in the conversation they have. She has no idea. You know, and it's like, that's so complex and so well done.
Yeah.
I love that so much.
It's beautiful. Did you love this line?
So you'll tell your parents for me?
Oh, that might be the funniest thing you've ever said.
Or what she says after with...
Can I just say that you have the worst timing ever?
Also, a nod to stand up.
Yeah.
To say you're a bad
timing.
Stand-up.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's beautifully
done. You have
done.
No timing.
I thought that I recently saw the Sorkin movie Molly's Game, which has Chastain and Idris Elba. His accent's all over the place in the movie, but still really fun and great. But I was thinking, and I was reminded watching this scene, all the production value, all the whatever, all the money in the world. Starring Kevin Spacey. You cannot compete with two actors talking to each other like the primary attractional element of a great scene. Like, it's just not gonna... This scene with Joel and you know, Michael and Rachel, it crushes. And it's something where it's like, this is why I love the shows I love. This is why I love the movies I love.
Yeah.
When it's just like, oh yeah, they're just kind of talking to each other.
Yeah.
But just like, oh, it's the best. almost theatrical in that sense, too.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
Stripped down, bare bones.
And after this scene comes my favorite line in the entire show, and I totally should have told you to pull a clip for it, but she walks into her parents' house. It's what her mom says to her when she sees her. Like, she storms into her dad's house, and... You know, she's like, Papa, Papa, Papa. He immediately calls for her mom, and he won't talk to her because he knows that you're in your pajamas. Something's wrong. Yeah. He doesn't want to deal with it. He gets up. He walks away. She finally comes into the room and she says,
what are you wearing? It's not thinning.
One sentence. Like,
yeah.
What are you wearing? It's not thinning. Mm-hmm. Like, her first instinct is to be like, oh my God, that doesn't look good. Like, just nitpicking her daughter, like, from the get-go. Yeah. So great.
Well, and I'm so excited, as someone who's only seen the pilot, to watch how the parental relationship distinguishes and differentiates itself from, like, Emily Richard dynamics.
No, they don't
Lorelai.
Deal with it very much.
Really?
Just kidding.
Okay. No, but I'm curious to see, because, I mean... I will say, Shaloub from the jump is
Shaloub
rocking it.
Shaloub from the jump, yo.
Papa,
just an elegant sonata.
When I agreed to send you to that fancy Goethe college.
This is so
What
good.
Was the one thing I told you?
They'll have terrible deli.
The important thing I told you.
That was about deli, too.
The other important thing I told you.
Don't pick a weak man.
A weak man. Don't
a
pick a weak man.
Man.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have to look pretty hard in 1958, you know?
Shaloub is rocking it in a way that I haven't seen him do.
No?
And no, not that I thought he was bad,
he
but
was
I just
wonderful.
I just love him in this role.
I love him in a parental role, for sure. And because he really brings the love, you know, to the screen in a very detached parenting role. Mm-hmm. He's warm. He's a warm dude. That is a good... That's another good pivotal moment where it's like, okay, yeah, you're going to be blamed for, you know, things that don't go right in your life. Even if your husband leaves you for his younger secretary, you shouldn't have picked him.
You know, when you're writing a family that is Jewish and Jewish people are writing it, I guess you have the license to make jokes like this.
You have to pick your friends as if there's a war going on. You want a husband who'll take a bullet for you, not one who points to the attic and says, they're up there.
That was really good.
Wow,
that
right?
That was dark and good. They made a lot of Holocaust
Nazi jokes.
References.
I know.
Yeah, he was in Buchenwald. Throw him a bone.
Wow.
That was amazing.
By the way, I wasn't, even after watching this 3 or 4 times, I wasn't quite clear on how Maisel's children work. Do they just stay with her parents?
Yes, a lot of the time.
So that's clarified.
When Midge goes out, they stay with with the parents. And I think that I saw it as a historical accuracy thing. Like, it probably happened a lot of the time where kids would just be with their parents. And I also thought, Welcome Home, ASP, you can write about a time period in which children really were, like... The way that she treated them in Gilmore. Remember how they would just be these afterthoughts that were running around all the time?
Oh, Suki had like 12 children and it was just
no
like,
one ever saw any of them or
buttons.
Cared about them.
Yeah.
And that's, they're set dressing.
Yeah.
And in the 50s, they really were
set
dressing.
Yeah, so you don't have to deal with
it. Yeah, I mean, that's like what Mad Men is about.
Yeah. Although, okay, I had a weird, it's not really a trigger, but I had a weird thing. When she was calling Ethan's name, where I couldn't help but hear it in a particular cadence or rhythm.
Oh, boy.
Ethan.
Oh, I thought you were going to parallel it with something from Gigi.
What would you parallel it with something from Gigi?
Michelle.
Oh, Michelle.
Michelle. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it seemed very Lorelai.
I know. There's certain things where it's like, is this a Palladinoism? I don't know. If someone just repeats a word or
no,
a phrase a lot.
Any repeating is a Palladinoism, and she actually gets a royalty.
Penny Pan.
Yeah.
So all this happens. Her life has fallen apart. So Midge gets a little drunk on wine.
Manischewitz wine, right?
Manischewitz. And then goes back to the gaslight.
And this is where the night gets epic, right?
Right.
Like, so much happens.
I want to talk about this scene for 2.5 hours.
Okay. Okay, great. The first gaslight scene.
Yeah. The final gaslight scene.
I cannot wait for you to see the next gaslight scene.
Really?
The one where she goes up the second time.
It's, really? Oh, I can't wait.
There's a thing that happens.
Oh, this is fun, right? You're teasing things to me.
It's one of the funniest, very Amon Sherman Palladino moves. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I'll say, just in contrast to the first time I saw, the first time I watched this pilot, however many months ago, and contrasting it to now, where I watched it this week again, a couple times this week again, I will say it was amazing the first time I watched it. And this second time, it was way more emotionally loaded the second time. I don't know exactly why that is, but there was something, I think everything about it is pretty perfect. I mean, and you can speak to it as someone who's actually a stand-up, because there's almost like this mythical nature to it where it's like, I don't think this has ever actually happened, where it's like a drunk lady went up and crushed it with observational comedy and things about bowel movements. But the way where it's like, oh yeah, this is a heightened world. No one talks like this. That's the appeal. There's like a mythic nature to like Mrs. Maisel's first time on the stand-up. And it's almost like it plays out as a retelling of it. But I'll say it's almost akin to, as someone who at one point was a young man, and there were like superhero movies and stuff. So you watch Spider-Man getting in touch with his powers, and he's jumping off buildings, and there's always the woohoo moment where he's going from building to building. This is that with Midge, and this is her discovering her superpower in a way that she hadn't quite exercised before. And I wept watching it this time. I was like, it was surprising, but I was like, I'm crying at this scene of like, it's not a sad scene or anything, but it's just so like joyous to see her get in touch with it.
And
it,
soar,
Yeah, because it almost reminded me of when they first show the island in Wonder Woman, and it's just strong women training with each other.
Yeah.
I think everyone in our group of friends like teared up or was crying, because it was like, we just haven't seen it before, where it's like a female gaze and it's just strength and it's just beautiful to see. And I don't know if I've seen quite this before, where you see a woman discovering this, and in a way that's not gender blind too. So it's not like, oh, if Sorkin writes a character, it's like CJ could be a man too on the West Wing, Allison Janney.
Right.
But this is like, it's feminine. She shows her bare breasts at the end. And it's not for the sake of sexual provocation. It's like a strength.
Right.
In a way.
She's fully, well, we've also gotten to know her as a human being, regardless of gender, to the point where it doesn't, like, I think if it was the first thing that happened, it would be, oh, she's being mannish or whatever. Yeah. But we know Midge to be somebody who has the swagger. I do think that this could have happened. I think there's a lot of lead up to this moment. And I think in a certain circumstance, a perfect storm, this could be a thing that really did happen, because at this point, we're looking at stand-up as maybe a 20-year new thing.
Sure.
It's not established enough that there's really, there, you know, there's not one scene versus another. I mean, I'm sure there were scenes, but like, there's not alt comedy versus, you know,
like club comics versus,
there's just
East Coast, West Coast. Yeah.
So so people would walk up on stage and talk, and then have jokes and tags and those kinds of things. But like, anybody working out their set at the Gaslight, this could have been somebody being drunk, and it didn't necessarily need to be even comedy. It could have just be a person talking and doing poetry. That's why I think it's important that it's a multi-discipline open mic, right?
So
like, she gets up on stage, and she also, I think this is important to point out, doesn't kill. There's a lot of awkward going on. Like, their audience is talking back, and they're like, what's happening on stage right now? And she just starts talking to them, and it's like this natural kind of like,
she's so drunk
and it's moving into it, and the people are talking to her, and she's like, okay. And then that moment when she grabs the microphone and
I have that exact moment, actually.
You feeling better now?
Turn to the guy coming out of the bathroom, grabs the mic.
So my life completely fell apart
today.
Did I mention that my husband left me?
Woohoo!
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, yeah, it's weird, and people don't know how to react.
Did I mention that he left me for his secretary? She's 21 and dumb as a Brillo pad. And I'm not naive. I know that men like stupid girls, right? But I thought Joel wanted more than stupid. I thought he wanted spontaneity and wit. I thought he wanted to be challenged. You know what I mean? You two are going to be together forever.
That's so good. Like, the stuff that she does, like, you wouldn't do during a stand-up set. That's like, you would never, like, call out a couple in an audience, like, and insult them. They're part of your show. Like, the rest,
I feel like a good stand-up wouldn't, I think. Probably shitty stand-ups do.
Well, shitty stand-ups maybe do, but, like, that's part of their shtick or whatever, but, like, you wouldn't want to, you know what I mean? Like, she does, she makes all these mistakes because she's not doing stand-up. She's just talking on stage in front of a stand-up audience, and she's, she's discovering, but she's also not aware of what she's doing. You know, later on we discover that she's not trying to do stand-up.
Right.
She just was like trying to figure out what it was
she was,
that
just talking.
What was in her husband's head.
It wasn't, this is my moment, I got to go up there. It was just such a natural overflow of all these things that existed within
her before.
She was going,
it was like she was going through Penny Pan's like makeup drawer.
You know? Yeah, in a way.
She was in Joel's territory, looking around going, well, what the fuck?
Yeah, it was coping and grieving.
So this is what he was doing.
Oh my, I mean, it's start to finish, it gives me chills.
It's like, so well done.
And just the direction too, the guy turning the spotlight on her.
Yes.
Susie coming up and being like, holy shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And too, like, not to harp too much on nudity stuff, because I don't know how to do it a lot without sounding like a pig. But I will say, I think it is so hard. You know what?
Oink, oink, you said hard.
But I will say, the movie that you were in, Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates.
Thank you.
Where there was a scene where, remind me.
Stars Hall Out.
Remind me the actress's name, who is naked.
Right.
And it's not played for titillation. It's played for laughs.
Yeah.
Even though she's like, obviously a beautiful woman.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a hard thing to do and contextualize well.
Right.
Where it's like you saw her in that movie through the eyes of her brother. So you weren't like, yeah, you were like, oh no, you know, and it was funny for all those reasons. I think it's, and obviously Brosnahan's a beautiful young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, it blew my mind that you could do that and have it not be gratuitous, but just like almost flag planting of, yeah, this is me.
Well,
here's
the difference between that scene in Mike and Dave and all mm-hmm. the scenes you kind of are prepared, you've seen before of tits.
Uh-huh.
What's going on in this is that a woman is showing herself and she has total agency. You know, yeah, she's drunk, but she knows that she's being looked at.
Yeah.
She knows she's in front of a crowd. She's talking about her body in a way that she's proud of it. It's her body. She works on it. It's her, you know, it's something that she feels proud of, and she's sharing it, not in a way where it's like in any way she's like inviting the audience to degrade her.
Mm-hmm.
She's inviting the audience to objectify something that she is proud of, being an object, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
I have
yeah.
great tits, look at my tits, not like I have great tits, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
there's like a difference
mm-hmm.
between a woman presenting herself to be sexualized, objectified, and degraded, and a woman presenting herself to be objectified in a way that like is part of her presentation of her entire self.
And she's in control.
And she's in control of what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's so funny to me as a feminist, like, and it's like, oh yeah, the cops hate that.
Yeah.
I mean, right? Because like the cops don't bust up a strip club, you know, where it's like men are there enjoying nakedness, you know, like maybe they did, but like there's a bunch of strip clubs in Times Square at the time. But like a woman talking and being in control of the moment the way you are when you do stand up and then showing her tits, it's like, yeah, no.
Yeah, when
like
it's not
that.
Happening in,
no,
in
now
a
you're under
frame
arrest.
That they're comfortable
yeah, it's
with.
Not
yeah.
my choice that you took off your top. So I don't like that.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Can we talk more about cops? And which lives we think matter? Was it you I was talking with? Blue Lives Matter might be about the Smurfs.
I've always said hot lives matter.
Hot lives matter. I've always said.
Hot lives? That's weird.
No lives matter.
Yeah, yeah.
We're all bad. Yeah, so it's beautifully done.
That's worse than all lives matter.
No lives matter is worse.
No lives matter is so much worse.
Oh, yeah. So just gorgeous. And I did like the guy shouting, maybe if there was a hashtag for this episode.
Fuck Penny Pan.
Penny Pan.
Pan.
So well done.
Yeah, really great.
She
great
goes
stuff.
To the slammer, Susie, but you know.
Bails her out. She was in the slammer for 20 minutes. She comes out changed.
And then they have that scene.
Right.
Boris scene in Brosnahan where it's like, oh, this is like one of the best scenes Galdino's ever done.
I know I'm right about this. It's like I know that unless I somehow get rich enough to hire some German broad to walk me around the park twice a day in my old age, I'm going to spend my entire life alone.
That's not true.
Fine. I don't mind being alone. I just do not want to be insignificant. Do you?
Oh my God.
Right?
Right? Yeah. That, I had cried when I saw that. Yeah.
But, and two, like showing these two awesome women who define greatness in totally different ways, where mm-hmm. she's like, yeah, I don't mind being alone.
Yeah.
But I want significance.
This is my path.
Yeah.
It was chilling. It was.
Two, like, chilling scenes in a row.
Totally.
Where you kind of get into her. It's just cool to see, like, oh yeah, Maisel isn't the only way. Susie isn't the, like, yeah. Both things at the same time can be as true and valid.
Right.
A path for greatness for an individual.
Right.
It was really, really lovely. And I think some of the best acting porn scenes ever done. Oh, I never watched Getting On, though. Did you ever watch that?
I did see Getting On. I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was incredible. I can see why, now that you told me that thing about Luke being a woman in the beginning, it's like, oh yeah, this has been marinating with ASP for such a long time that of course right. It's this strong.
And Borstein as a regular yes. in a Palladino show has been made because she was cast as Suki and then she right. had Mad TV, so then it was recast with McCarthy.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, you're finally seeing the greatness.
Yeah.
That's always been there, but just never quite in this particular
so
capacity.
Cool. Gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah. And too, because obviously Borstein's done a lot of live comedy. I'm mm-hmm. sure she can speak to the role in ways that, you know, maybe some actresses couldn't.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
And then she, after she goes to the slammer, gets bailed out. They have the conversation. She goes to, weirdly, a communist party.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't understand that.
There's an extra there that looks a lot like me. Guy with the same red haircut and a jean
jacket.
Is
it you?
Kevin. It's not. Hopefully that'll be season two. That'll be our cameo season. Also, Susie had one of the best closing lines of that scene as well.
So I'm eating peanuts.
You showed your tits to half of Greenwich Village. You think the fucking nuts are what's going to piss them off? To go.
That's great. Welcome home, Amy Sherman-Palladino, to ASP. Streaming. This show can thrive and exist for a very long time
mm-hmm.
in a way that Paladin, I mean, Gilmore ran for 7 years, but it just feels like I'm glad we're in a place now where there's amazing shows that yeah. went for 5 years that I've never watched and you've never watched.
Yeah.
And this will be one of those shows for some people. This will not be a monocultural Game of Thrones thing.
No.
This will never be like, oh shit, Breaking Bad, you gotta watch it. You right. know, it's gonna get dropped in 8-episode doses maybe for the next 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And some people will discover it, some won't, but it's just gonna be able to exist.
You know what's crazy? Like my family all watches this show.
Really?
Yeah. Like my uncles and aunts yeah. and like that's the sort of generationally like people in their 50s watch this and maybe older people too because it's about a time period mm-hmm. that they're more familiar with.
It's comforting.
And it's comforting. Yeah. But like ASP also writes this kind of TV that's like really comforting to watch and like really pleasurable like you were saying. So I think that makes sense that, you know, people that watch People of Earth, for instance, the other show that I'm involved with.
Shuts out.
What if it was what if it was belabored? Guys, watch People of Earth, by the way. I love it so much. And I want it to keep going because I love the people I work with so much. We have to talk about what happens after the party.
Sure.
She goes back to the gaslight
mm-hmm.
and like she's having that moment of realizing like she could maybe do this.
Yeah, because she sees another guy stealing new heart.
Poorly.
New heart's routine.
You know,
yeah. Even worse than Joel. Yom Kippur-ly.
And then what happens next? She goes back to find... This is the only thing I had with the episode.
Okay.
She goes to...
Yeah, do we have a lot of negative things to say about
that? No.
I'm saying...
She leaves the gas... She leaves the bar next to the gaslight where she's talking to Susie. Goes directly to the gaslight.
Uh-huh.
Ostensibly at the gaslight asks where to find Susie, which it's like maybe the bar you were just at 1 second ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then gets on the subway and goes to that party. So that did confuse me. Like, when is this all happening? Because I felt like it was all happening on the night before Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day.
Oh, yeah. I took it to mean that too.
You know, when she's in the green dress, that's the morning of Yom Kippur.
That green dress. Guys.
Hello.
Again, welcome home, ASP. Hats galore in the 1950s.
Everybody's got to have a hat. Yeah.
Yeah. And then she has that final scene with Lenny Bruce, whose wife goes to the wrong jail at first because she thought, which all that business was very funny. And then big shouts out to Luke Kirby, who plays Lenny Bruce.
Very well done.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's nice to be dealing in a time period where you're not comparing him to like, it's not like I've seen so much Lenny Bruce. I'm like, oh, this is weird.
That's
or Uncanny
true.
Valley.
Or he's playing Robin Williams or something. Yeah, somebody we're all.
And I hope, and you can tease us or not tease us, but I hope they don't get into too familiar territory with the celebrities on this show, or like the standards where it's like a young Woody Allen watches from across the bar and some guy doing a Woody Allen impression.
I won't tease that.
Okay. But that being said, they have this exchange where she asks Lenny Bruce, and this to me felt very directly. I've heard Amy Sherman-Palladino in interviews say, look, I can't do anything else. I can't do anything but write TV shows. All I can do is this.
Mm-hmm.
All I have to rely on for future shows is Gilmore Girls and maybe what I did on Bunhead. Like, this is it for me. So Midge asks Lenny Bruce, stand-up comedy. Do you love it?
Okay, let's put it like this.
If there was anything else in the entire world that I could possibly do to earn a living, I would. Anything. I'm talking dry cleaners to the Klan, crippled kid portrait painter, slaughterhouse attendant. If someone said to me, Leonard, you can either eat a guy's head or do 2 weeks at the Copa, I'd say pass the fucking salt. It's a terrible, terrible job. It should not exist. Like cancer and God.
And then she says, yeah, but do you love it? And he just, in a rare wordless ASP moment, just shrugs mm-hmm. perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah. He loves it.
I get that now a lot better now that you said that about ASP, because that's her talking. Mm-hmm. So that's good to me. Because, and maybe that's how Lenny Bruce feels about it or felt about it. Maybe that's the time yeah. period of what it meant to do stand-up, and maybe it was more of a slog than it is now. But from what I know of stand-up, most people know that there's aspects of the job that are so shitty that you would say something to the effect of like, ugh, this job sucks. But you would never really say I'd do anything else, because no matter what it is, like at the end of the night, you've always gone on stage and talked and made people yeah. laugh for your job. And yeah. so it's like everybody that I know that talks about stand-up, that does stand-up as their living, anybody in the Lenny Bruce category would never say I would do anything else if I could. Like, you know what I mean? That's not a perspective. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing that I felt was inaccurate. Like,
that rubbed up against your understanding
don't
of stand-up.
Feel that way. Yeah. You know, they would say like, yeah, of course I love it. I mean, it's awful, but I love it, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's awful, but I love it. It's yeah. much more the primary
yeah.
perspective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, again, yeah,
that,
I think
like,
that might...
burdensome, oh my God, it's such a slog. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It really isn't. Like, there's parts of doing stand-up that are insanely shitty, and you have to go to these hotels, yeah. and it's awful, and, like, there's, like, 8 years where it sucks. But, like, the part of it that's glorious is so glorious that it complete, and the people that you get to hang out with,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, that's just it's unbelievable.
Yeah, so you didn't connect with that. Yeah, because it does almost seem like an old-fashioned attitude.
Yeah,
in that sense.
It does.
Although, I think you and I both know people who are like, yeah, I do comedy, but I kind of hate, like, people who do
that's
have
true.
Semblances of that attitude, yeah, but yeah, then yeah. at the end, like, they are chasing joy and bliss.
Well, yeah, or like Paul F. Tompkins, for instance, he's talked about how he's like, I'm just not going to do certain things anymore. Like, I don't want to perform for certain, you know, and some stand-ups are not like that. They want to be able to perform for any crowd. Yeah.
He said that when you asked him to be on this show, right?
Or, you know, I don't know why, but I think of Joe Mandy or whatever. You know, like, he's not a guy who's like, oh, I just love the, you know, I love stand-up so much that I yeah. love hanging out with other stand-ups, yeah. talking stand-up. Like, he probably has his own set of things that he likes to yeah. do that are not, you know, every single aspect of stand-up. But I love stand-up so much that I just, I'll go to any show anytime. It's my favorite thing.
Really? You know, you'll go and watch people and be
I'll go
supportive.
All the time. I love to yeah. go watch people. I, you know.
Because so many of them are your friends at this point. It's like going to
I just love.
Your buddies.
I love watching yeah. people bomb. I love watching people kill. I love. Yeah. It's never not fun for me, or at least in some way tickles my brain. It's educational.
I love the fact that before we were even friends, years before, I saw you on stage so many times and I thought you were funny as hell.
Really?
And that we get to be friends.
That's
now.
Awesome.
Yeah. I've right. admired you for many, many years.
Aw, thank you.
Our love and our
the
relationship
more
is
you
real.
Know. Mm-hmm. I'm uncomfortable. So
I know what? You have a boyfriend. I know.
He's right.
It's not
here.
Okay.
How's it going, Kevin?
Hey, you're kind of a cool guy.
I'm a cowboy from
yeah.
the South.
I like your Spurs, man.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin.
Oh, that hat tip was very polite.
No problem.
Well, you gotta go now, you say?
It's more of a hat tick. As you can see, I can't stop doing it.
Oh, there's smoke coming from off your
oh,
arm.
Oh, God. Pour some water on me, darling.
Yeah.
Here you go.
You know what? Now, we can tease a segment that we might do next time
yeah.
on the show. And actually,
I should probably do a jangle.
A little jangle.
A jingle or a jangle.
A jingle jangle. We'll have a jingle jangle by the next time, the next
Alrighty.
Episode. Yeah. Well, you know, this is a process of discovery, mm-hmm. getting back into
and of elimination.
Mm.
One of us is going to leave.
Wait, is that how the season ends?
Yeah,
is one of
vote,
us has to...
Every episode, one of us gets voted off.
Oh, no.
It's just only one more episode
okay.
after this.
I mean, I guess that's fair. I think it's going to be me every time, though. No, but one thing
Ending
we talked
so
about... Well, the combination of the time and setting and Miss Palladino and her tendencies, Alice thought it might be helpful to do a section called
the correction section, where there's no perfection.
The correction section where there's no perfection.
The correction section where there's no such thing as perfection.
So speak on this. What are we trying to do in this section?
So Amy Sherman-Palladino does not have a good track record in dealing with cultural issues, LGBTQ stuff, gender stuff. She's always a little iffy. And
that said, we love you, Amy. And I do still want her to come on this show.
She should. If she knows what's good for her, she will. But we're also two goy white people who don't... you know, we can't speak to all the myriad cultural issues that she might have, that ASP might have missed in her writing. And so we wanted to invite the viewers of the show and listeners of the cast to correct us. And so we're going to talk about different things that ASP does right, maybe, and wrong, maybe, and try to grapple with, like, you know, what it must be like for a person of color to watch a show, a gay person, what have you. And then what we'll do is correct each other as much as possible and then make a bunch of mistakes for you to correct, and then we'll listen to you and learn and hopefully educate some of our super pasty white listeners as well.
We're not any definitive authoritative word on anything, and Mm-mm. we accept that position, but you know, we can speak in this section about things that kind of trip our wires, such as lines like
"you get chick raped."
Like that. That would be a perfect thing to talk right. about in the correction section.
Sure.
Oh, is that making light of rape culture? Right. I will say, in the press tour for season one of Maisel, because everything that happened at Amazon and the current right. climate of sexual harassment and whatnot, man, Palladino's love a good sexual harassment joke. Like, oh, she's going to be on Johnny Carson's couch. Well, not that couch. Like, there's a lot of that happening. Yeah. So that's fun.
That is.
So yeah, you can look forward to that in next week's episode. And you can look forward to us next week. And for that stuff and for these episodes, what were you going to say?
And we can look forward to a guest coming through.
We'll have some Lala special guests coming up.
No, we're not going to say.
No, we won't tease. Because okay. people can drop out. Or
their
not
name
drop
rhymes
out.
With Bud Blapitow.
Their name rhymes with Kel Crooks.
Kel Crooks. We didn't do the Danny Strong clip.
Oh, there was a voice cameo, not a Viz cameo.
Is it really him?
Listen.
Doing
the
out.
Eternal war yeah. is here. Oh, victory. Forget your...
I think he confirmed as much on Twitter. I think he did say so, if I remember correctly, when the pilot first came out.
Yeah, and that's a very Ginsburg-y, like, that would make sense that he wants to do. Yeah, okay.
1,000%.
1,000%. Danny Strong goes to my gym.
What a great... Does he really?
Mm-hmm.
He's not Danny Week.
Nope, that's true. That's where he gets
Danny Strong.
His last name.
What a great pilot.
Of our show?
No, of the TV show. But you know what? What a terrifically funny pilot of this podcast as well.
I agree.
Alice, I love you. And
I
admire
you
so much.
I admire you too.
I'm so glad you still talk to me.
We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. No. So yeah, guys, thanks for joining us. I mean, the plan right now is to do... The next 7 episodes, we're going to put them out one a week for the next 7 weeks after mm-hmm. this. They'll come out Mondays. Mm-hmm. And you can look for them in this feed. We just figured we're going to put them in this feed because that's where people are subscribed already, even though it is a separate show. And yeah, we'll see. Maybe we'll like cap it off with a bonus 9th episode where we go through feedback. But for any questions you might have, or things for the corrections section, or other feedback, or other ways to yell at us, you can still email. You can email GilmoreGuysShow@gmail.com. And our Twitter is still going to be Gilmore Guys Show. I'm not going to change the Twitter.
Don't change it.
I'm not going to, like...
Change the picture.
I could change the picture.
Just the picture.
Oh, yeah. But we don't have cover art.
Couldn't you change your at name and the people are still subscribed? Don't people do that?
Yeah, but I would... But what if we lost it and someone else took it?
Oh, can that happen?
Yeah. Hashtag is complicated, I think.
Okay.
I think. I'm not sure. But anyway, this is going to be a fun, easy, breezy, lemon squeezy.
Let's just call it, like, Maisel Get Nazis Off Twitter or something like that.
But this is fun. Like this is like a fun opportunity, because I think for both of us too, to just enter into something where it's like, yeah, it's like a month and a half of our life where we talk about that. It's not like for the next 3 years we're gonna be in this room.
Yeah.
Although we'll be like, we'll see at the end. Maybe we'll want to do the next season when
who
it comes
knows?
Out. We'll see. Again, well, I might get voted off by the end of it.
By the end of this episode.
Yeah. So yeah. I guess we can do plugs at the end, right? Just me and you?
Yeah.
Plug our own stuff and then...
I feel like I need to storm out at a certain point, though, also.
Wait, is that how we...
You don't like that.
I feel uncomfortable. I feel like I might actually put my feelings hurt.
By oh, that. That's amazing. I like that you stand in your truth and you know your emotions.
Well, it is so my fear. But you can if you want to. If you want to do it for episode 8, I think that might be funny.
Okay, all right.
But let's not plan it too much. We're doing it right now. You can find me at Kevin T. Porter everywhere, and at Kevin T. Porter. And if you want to hear more of me on a weekly basis, you can listen to the Good Christian Fun podcast, which Alice has been a guest on.
I sure have.
That's been super fun. It's not just for Christians. It's not even primarily for Christians.
It's not for Christians, actually.
It's not at all for Christians. For anyone named Kristen.
No.
You can't listen. No.
And if you're in Los Angeles, you can come out to Flappers on the 17th or on the 10th. I'm going to be performing in Venice at the Venice Fringe Show with Sabrina Jalice and JC Coakley. I'll also be on Wednesday the 24th at Flappers. And I'm also doing some touring, so check my website at Alice Wetterlund on Twitter, at Alice Wetterlund on Instagram. Didn't it sound like professional or whatever?
Yes.
It never happened. So, and you can also listen to my other podcast, Treks in the City with Veronica Osorio.
Veronica.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kevin.
So lovely. I'm so thrilled to be here.
I know. I'm so
hanging out
too.
With you and
good.
Talking. This is going to be so fun. So we'll see you here for the next 7 episodes of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goise. Let's go out with the closing song they used in this very episode.
Let's do it.
Girls talk.
Girls just want to have talks.
They just want to have talks. We'll see you next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Goodbye.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.